Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for October the 9th, 2017. This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hello, David, and good evening to everyone out there. Yes, tonight we have a very special guest, Lauren Price, a founder and public affairs representative for a group called Veteran Warriors, which is based in Florida but has a national agenda to help improve VA programs and services for veterans and their families. Before she joins us in a moment, though, I would want to remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, your comments, and your questions. So you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free number is 1-888-627-6008. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Richard. Let me begin with an introduction of our special guest this evening. Lauren Price is the founder of Veteran Warriors, a national veterans advocacy group, and she has led that organization since its creation in 2009. She has testified before Congress on veteran issues. As far as career training and experience, she graduated from Omega Institute in New Jersey with the paralegal certification in 1987. She also has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice with a minor in psychology from St. Leo University. She has nearly two decades of experience in the legal profession. Of particular significance to our discussion tonight on this show, she served in the United States Navy for a decade between January 2005 and January 2015, including serving for more than a year in Iraq as a convoy driver as well as a public affairs officer in Baghdad. She also served as the Intel and Logistics Lead Petty Officer at the Defense Logistics Agency, United States Central Command. She co-founded the veterans group called Veterans Warriors with her husband, Jim Price, who is a retired Navy Senior Chief. Military service is a proud tradition in her family, with four of her five sons having served in the military as well. She is our guest tonight on the Veterans News Hour to talk about serving in Iraq war, as well as her experience dealing with the VA and fighting on behalf of the interests of veterans and their families, including testifying before Congress on veteran issues. So without further ado, I welcome Lauren Price to the Veterans News Hour. How are you tonight, Lauren?
I'm just fine. Thank you, David and Richard. I appreciate the invite.
Well, thank you for being on our show. We have lots to talk about, but for the benefit of our listeners, why don't we begin with your experience serving in the Navy, including more than a year in Iraq. What was that like? What was it like driving convoys in Iraq? What did your public affairs duty involve? Can you tell us about those things?
Well, driving a convoy in Iraq is interesting. And if anybody tells you that they didn't have fun doing it, they're lying. It was fun. It was terrifying, but it was fun. There were a lot of great times. I had a great crew with me, and we were fortunate enough to bring our entire convoy team of 25 people home. Everybody came home vertical. I enjoyed my tour over there. It was very, very eye-opening. I was the lead convoy driver, and one of my collateral duties was the public affairs officer for our battalion. And we were civil affairs, so lots of hearts and minds stuff. That meant every time we went on a mission, I'd dismount and go take pictures and interviews and things like that. There are some perks for it, too, though. Every time the USO came in with celebrities to do shows, I got backstage passes. But I got to meet a lot of very interesting people, some of the people in Iraq, the citizens. They're just like us. They just want everything to be normal and raise their kids and go to work and have nice lives. It was a big broadening experience to be there.
Wow. As far as the the challenge of driving convoys? I know you said that it was terrifying, but also I guess something that was a challenge that you took on. I didn't serve in Iraq, but certainly I followed things closely in the media, and certainly driving convoys to me would have seemed to have been one of the more dangerous duties, with IEDs, other attacks. What was your experience? You were over there in 2007, 2008. That was when there was the buildup of troops, because things have been going pretty badly for us for a few years before that. Isn't that right?
Yeah, actually, we got there in February of 2007, and we were there till March of 2008. And it was the highest death toll due to IEDs and VBIDs that American forces saw during the entire war.
Wow.
We were losing in our brigade about a truck a week, which meant four to five soldiers in each truck every week. And death-defying is an understatement. Picture every single crack in the road, every piece of falling trash, every other car on the road is a potential threat, and in many cases was an actual threat. And I was the lead driver, which meant I was always out in front. I was the one that, if I drove them in the wrong direction, we could all die. And
wow.
That is a heavy burden when you're doing it, to know that if you just literally turn the steering wheel wrong, that you could lead 40 people to death. But you don't think about that part of it. You just think about, oh, my God, I don't want to die.
Right.
And the fun stuff is like taking a 7-ton vehicle and doing Dukes of Hazzard in downtown Baghdad with it. That's fun stuff. Knocking a city bus out of the way because they got too close and they wouldn't move. Or taxi cab. I've been known to push more than one taxi cab out of my way. That's what I mean. It's just, and then you go into places that aren't urban areas, that it's actually more scary. Farming communities were actually more dangerous for us. But
and why was that? Why
overall,
were the farming communities more dangerous?
Because there were more places to hide.
I see.
For terrorists with RPGs and insurgents with RPGs and things like that, they could hide in the crops growing on the side of the road. They could, because everybody there has a gun. Everybody, all the citizens, the males, all have weapons. So you can't just assume that just because a 12-year-old has an AK that he's a danger or a threat. The problem is that he could be. So the guy walking down the road with his mule, with a big load on his mule that also has an AK strapped to his back, you don't know if that mule is actually set to blow up. So it was literally a daily thing. We were on the road usually 5 to 6 days a week. And our short missions were from Camp Liberty down to, some of your listeners will know the Green Zone or Camp FOB Freedom, IZ. It was a 12-mile ride. Those were our short runs. That 12 miles would take us about 3 hours to get there.
Wow.
And because of we were restricted to how fast we could go, we were restricted to where we could drive. And then sometimes we get halfway there and, oh, road's gone black, which means there's been a bomb go off, so we have to reroute. Literally a lot of thinking on your feet or on your seat.
Wow. Did you all feel like you had enough resources? And what I'm thinking about in terms of that is the EOD folks and the equipment. We've represented some veterans that worked in EOD, and I have a nephew that works in EOD in the Air Force. As far as both the vehicles and enough people to be searching out these IEDs, did you all feel like by that point in the war in 2007, 2008 that you had
there was never enough EOD. There's
yeah.
never enough. if we'd had our way, there'd have been three times as many EOD guys there. But the ones that we had, they were doing their job. They were doing 10 times their job. And frankly, we brought our entire convoy team home upright because of those guys. Because they went out and did the job that most of us couldn't do. So I will tell you, the only thing that we were short on was, and even when we had really bad things happen, the only thing we were short on was ridiculous, stupid things. Like, there's these, for the Rhino, which is, it's a device that sticks out the front of your Humvee to actually set off IEDs in advance of you rolling over the top of them. And they require what's called a glow plug. It kind of looks like a spark plug. They come out of John Deere tractors. We couldn't get glow plugs.
Wow.
So if they burned out, we needed more. They're useless without them. I was fortunate enough to have a friend here in Florida, actually, from Patriot Guard Riders that was sending me cases of them.
Wow.
So those were the kind of dumb things that we couldn't get. We had steak. We had lobsters. We had crab. We ate well. Our trucks pretty much had everything we needed. And like I said, as far as support or the QRF guys, the quick response forces that would come in and basically they're your backup, those guys were all there when we needed them.
Wow.
Yeah, but we had dumb things we needed. So I have to say, in spite of what a lot of the media put out, we had the resources we needed.
I see. Well, that's good, because I know in 2003, at the time of the invasion, you know, there was a problem of the Humvees. They weren't properly armored for even the routine threats and IEDs, and the Secretary of Defense at that time, Rumsfeld, famously said, you know, and it was true, I suppose, that you don't go to war with what you want necessarily. You go to war with what you have at that time, but that's where planning and logistics and all those other things ought to come into play. But in any event...
Well, we really go to war planning it.
Yeah, as you go along, huh?
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about... I'm intrigued by what you were saying about, you know, the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people as far as the civil affairs, public affairs duties. Can you enlighten us more about that and what your impressions were and what that actually involved? How do you go about winning the hearts and minds of citizens of a country that has just been basically torn apart and been constant war for a long time?
Well, I will tell you, I actually got a big lesson before I even went over there. My middle son was in Afghanistan in 2005-06. And he had to manage a lot of the locals. That was actually part of his job. And he had told me, it's like basically they're just like us. He said they, you know, there's always a language barrier or just perception barriers. He said, but they're just like us. So I took that with me, was that, you know, they're just like us. And I had the luxury of getting to train the very first female Iraqi soldier.
Wow.
And she was a mom. She had a 4-year-old little boy named Ali. And because she was a woman and married and had a child, she was required to bring her child with her for convoy training.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, it was hilarious. And Ali, of course, became, you know, like our little mascot. But they really did want the same thing. They wanted all the same things that we did. They wanted their country to stop being a war zone. They wanted to, you know, have parties, and they wanted to have weddings, and they wanted to just raise their children. And I got to meet somebody who was probably the most profound impacting on me. He was a brigadier general for the Iraqi ground forces. His name was Brigadier General Ghazi. And he was like somebody's grandpa. And he was like the nicest man I've ever met.
Wow.
And he kind of took a shine to me. And I was actually responsible later on for training some of his troops. And he gave me this beautiful little plate as a thank you for taking care of his men. And
wow.
He would sit around and tell us stories. He was Kurdish. So he would tell us these stories about his people. And, you know, it's like sitting around with your grandparents. So that's really the hearts and minds, is not being a military force, but being a human force.
Right. Whatever became of that general, do you know?
I don't know what happened to General Ghazi. After a year after I left, I have a friend that I served with over there, but he stayed on to work for the State Department. And he worked with General Ghazi for another year. And I don't know what happened, because General Ghazi was older. He was probably close to 70 when I was there. But after my friend left, I don't know what happened to General Ghazi.
Because you mentioned he was Kurdish, and I know the Kurdish people and the Iraqi government, you know, going back, I guess, forever, the animosity, the fighting, et cetera.
Yeah.
Just wondering how it might have played out. It's still playing out, I guess, with
yeah,
ICE.
Unfortunately. They relied on us a lot, and unfortunately, we kind of let them down.
Yeah. Well, I know after the first Gulf War, I was on active duty at the first Gulf War, and certainly the Kurdish people felt we let them down after that. But anyway, well, I appreciate your insights and sharing that with us tonight. What I want to do is turn it over to Richard Hurley. He has some questions for you about your organization and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Richard.
Yeah, thank you, David. Good evening, Lauren.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about your group, Veteran Warriors, and its goals and its project.
Well, Veteran Warriors, like most grassroots organizations, kind of came out of need rather than intent. We had a lot of people reaching out to us just because, not just my children, but someone in my family has served every generation going back to pre-Civil War or pre-Revolution in this country. So we have a lot of military and veteran knowledge. So friends, acquaintances would reach out to us for help, trying to get things accomplished, especially with the VA. And the culmination of those came when someone who is now a very dear friend, her husband was dying from exposures that he contracted, chemical exposures overseas, over in Iraq, and the VA was denying all of his benefits, 100% denied, nothing. And he was literally, when I met her, he was within 2 weeks of dying. They had lost their house. He hadn't been able to work since he got home. He hadn't even been home a year. And she was at her wit's end, and she actually had been referred through another acquaintance. And I got really pissed off about it, and I held a press conference. And within 24 hours of that press conference, the director of St. Petersburg Regional Office called her and said, oh, we've reviewed your husband's claim, and it's 100%. Yep, he's 100%. We're going to pay him. And then 5 days after he died, Prudential, who manages the SGLI program, which is the Soldiers Group Life Insurance, denied the claim. So I threatened to hold a second press conference on Prudential's doorstep. And they paid promptly. And it kind of went from there. Part of it is that I'm a 100% disabled veteran. I'm terminally ill. I contracted a terminal lung disease over in Iraq. I'm actually kind of a couple years past when I was supposed to die. They gave me 5 to 7 years from when I contracted it. And I've outlived them, outlived their prediction. And the VA has given me a really hard way to go. They've made it extremely difficult. And every time they make it difficult for me, I stop and think, well, I'm one of somewhere, the numbers change every year, but between 22 and 25 million veterans in this country. How many other veterans are being dealt with the same way? And it has yet to fail me to think that way, because every single time I have, whether it's trying to get a doctor's appointment or my claim rated or assistance with adaptable housing or something, every single time I find out there's not 10, there's not 1,000, there's 100,000 of them out there just like this. And it came down to the point where I realized that the system itself is beyond dysfunctional. it's beyond repair. The skeleton of it was never intended to be a federal agency, was never designed to be a federal agency, and it's been piecemealed together up to and including all of its supporting laws, piecemealed together since the 30s. And we need to truly overhaul it, like was done to the Internal Revenue Service back in the 80s. We need to go through soup to nuts. Military, we say, you know what, to elbows, and fix all the broken pieces to make the processes work the way they were intended to work.
And Rick, go ahead.
No, go ahead, David.
I was going to ask you, Lauren, with that background and your ideas on how to perhaps overhaul the VA, what would you say that your organization's present goals and its highest priority projects are?
Well, the present goal remains to overhaul the VA. And 4 years ago, we set about with separate teams working on separate sections of the VA. They have seven different vectors of the VA. Most people are pretty much only familiar with the claim side, the health care, the educational side, and burial benefits. There are actually seven vectors, one of which is also exclusively HR, the hiring and firing of people. I should just say the hiring, because they never fire anybody. We took teams and put teams together to identify, did true process mapping like we've done in the military. How is the system working right now? And what parts of the process are broken that it's not making it work right? So we created models that would take the existing resources that the VA had, both human and financial, and use those resources to restructure things to make them work the way they're intended. Those models have been presented to members of Congress on both sides of the aisle on repeated occasions. They've been extremely well received by both sides of the aisle. The biggest stumbling block we have is the union. The union and several what the VA called stakeholders. Those stakeholders, we've discovered, are the VSOs, because the big VSOs get grant money from the VA. And the union gets a lot of money from its employees from the VA. You take away millions and millions of dollars of incentives, and people get really upset with you. So the two stumbling blocks we have are the two who have the most to lose. Therefore, 4 years later, we still have not accomplished these things. We're hoping now with the new administration that we'll have a little better luck. That being said, that brings us to where we are now. The biggest project that we've been working on is we discovered a year ago, a little over a year ago, there's a small program in the VA called the Veteran Caregiver Program. That program was actually, it was Wounded Warrior Project, like flagship law. They got that through. It was set up for post 9/11 veterans, because this war and the current medical technology has sent home veterans that in every other war would have died on the battlefield. But these people are coming home catastrophically wounded and being retired and put back into society. For most cases, they require some level of care, whether it be a minimal amount of assistance just with day-to-day functions or to full-time, round-the-clock care, much like it would be in an assisted living facility. Congress looked at how much it would cost to keep one of those veterans, they're at what they call Tier 3, the highest level of care, in a nursing home. The cost would be just catastrophic. It would break the American bank. So they agreed that this program was a good thing, because we're going to pay the family member or the spouse to take care of that veteran at home. And it would be better for the veteran, because the veteran's not stuck in a nursing home. you know, we have a 22-year-old veteran that's got, he's a triple amputee and has severe TBI, brain damage. We're not going to leave him stuck in a facility. We're going to send him home with his family. We're going to help them accommodate him being at home. Sounds wonderful. Congress dropped the ball. They made the law. They funded the program. And then they basically handed the VA a blank check and said, go do with it what you will. They put one person in charge of the program who, while she's a social worker, she's actually a licensed clinical social worker who has a doctorate in social work. She doesn't have any hands-on experience, and she has no experience being a veteran or actually physically caring for veterans. That same person has been in charge of the program ever since. They put
and it
out.
It started when,
no,
Lauren? Well, I'm sorry.
The
go
program
ahead.
Was the program went into existence and functioning in 2011.
I see.
Since then, Congress has funded it every single year, and it's under the health care side, so it's funded a year in advance. They do that so that the hospitals and things like that won't be subjected to, you know, Congress having a fight or something and stopping the bills. But every year it's been funded. And every single year the VA goes back and says, we have X number more applications this year, a 50% increase in applications. We have this many people in the program, and we have 50% more applications, so we're going to need this much more money to run the program. What the program managers never did, and to this very second still have not done 6.5 years into the program, was created a policy manual, was created a process by which everybody has to function, the whole country, because it's a national program. There's not a consistent set of national rules for the program that each facility has to operate under. And the facilities are left to make up their own rules. And they're completely autonomous in how they manage the program. There's some basic rules that are written into the law, but the actual day-to-days have been left up to the individual facilities, which is very bad when you have a national program.
Yes.
What we discovered, it started last August. My husband was my full-time caregiver. He still is. He didn't lose that job. I have a lot of health issues from my service that most of them mean I need a full-time caregiver. I can't drive. I have blown out both my wrists driving complex. So they did major surgeries and partial amputations on both hands. I can't tie my shoes and a bunch of other things. My lung condition makes it so bad that there's pretty much not anything I can do for more than 10 minutes at a time. He was my full-time caregiver. My lung functions down to, last check was like between 35 and 40%. My hands will never grow back because I'm not an amphibian, so I won't regrow any of that. We got a call from the caregiver program nurse and said, congratulations, you've graduated. We're so happy for your recovery.
Wow.
Excuse me?
What no, I said that's from? Amazing.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was stellar. I was like, you're telling me something I don't know. No, we've decided that you've graduated. You've been in the program too long. The person that was calling me blatantly misquoted, and I mean outrageously misquoted, what the law says, and she told me it was a privately grant-funded program, and you have to understand that the money's going to run out. We can't keep people on here forever. Well, no, it's funded by Congress, by taxpayer dollars, and yes, you can, because that's the way the law was written. Well, you have no idea what you're talking about. I said, do me a favor. I know you have two computers on your desk. I said, on the other computer, I said, I want you to get on Google and Google my name before you tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. She shut up after that. Because then she did what I said, and she actually shut up because she figured out who I actually am and that I do know what I'm talking about. So I'm reading off to her chapter and verse of the law. We found out that the nurse actually lied and said she never got my civilian medical records in spite of her demand for them, and that was her word. When we got my VA medical records, we found where she fully documented where she had received them. We appealed to the director of the facility. He agreed with her revoking us from the program. We appealed to the VISN, who is like the regional director. Dr. Paz is his name. He not only agreed with it and supported us being revoked, he told Congressman Bill Rackus that essentially he felt I was lying because, and trying to make the VA look bad because we were told to submit records and we never did, in spite of the fact that we had their own records to show they got them.
Wow.
We were still denied. So he got really mad. And I said, like I said earlier, it's like, how in God's name can they do this? Where did this come from? And I started hearing things from social media, talking to other people around the country. The words like recovery-based program, temporary program, rehabilitation-based, graduating. These became buzzwords that were coming out of Colorado and San Antonio and El Paso and Albuquerque and Fort Sam Houston. I'm hearing these from all over the country. So wait one second. So just as everything else in the past, I'm not the only one. They're not just picking on me. They're not. So we opened a full-blown investigation, and I literally marshaled all of our team and said, we need to dig. We dug. Using the VA's own records, we discovered that 26,100 families had been revoked in the last 2.5 years.
Wow.
Considering that there's only 22,300 in the program presently, that's a lot. And we saw another big anomaly, that the tier threes, the highest level, that was one of the other things we were seeing a consistency of. People were being told tier threes only for bedridden, tier threes only for those who are like vegetative state, which is completely not true. But we also started seeing in the actual numbers that tier threes were being bumped down to tier twos, and that the tier three numbers were dropping and dropping across the country. And again, these are coming from the VA's own numbers. The director of the program has to submit reports to Congress. She's supposed to do it annually. That's actually in the law. In 2012, she decided to stop doing it annually and started doing it biannually. But we took her reports. One of my deep diving little secret squirrels found her reports, including the really wonderful PowerPoint. We took her own numbers, the numbers she gave to Congress. These are the numbers you're reporting.
And what were the congressional committees doing, if anything, at this point? Since they're the ones that passed the law about the program.
That was part of our angst. We had people across the country that were reaching out to the congressional leaders, and they're reaching back to the national director of the program. And she's giving everybody a lot of lip service, but is literally doing nothing. There's no movement. Nobody's changing what they're doing. So when we got involved, we start reaching out not just to these congressional leaders. We're reaching out to the committee. We're reaching out to the House Committee on Veterans Affairs and the Subcommittee on Health and the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. We're reaching to them and saying, look, this is what we see. So we put together, the first report we put together was showing the absolute numbers that were actually being revoked and the consistency of the statements across the country. This is basically an unwritten policy that went out. And if I ever get a whistleblower to come forward, I swear they're going to have steak dinner for the rest of their lives for me. Because somewhere there is a policy that went out by email or something like that, or some internal directive saying this is what's going to happen. They called the herd. Because when you talk about money, everything in the VA is about money.
Right.
This program has been not just fully funded, but over and above fully funded, because every single year, the program goes back and says, we have over 50% more applications coming in that are going to be processed. And these are the potential approvals. So we need this much more money. But they've never told Congress, oh, by the way, we're cutting 70% of our rolls, though, in the process. And the best example I love to give everybody, Prescott, Arizona, had 220 cases in their caseload. And 1 year ago, 220 cases in their caseload, they revoked, that is the term in the law, completely kicked out of the program, 188 of them.
Wow.
So suddenly, 188 out of 220 veterans were magically cured. It doesn't work that way.
But what have you found? Cause I believe you said you're in Congressman Bill Arrakis from
Bill
Arrakis. North, and he's the, as I recall, he's the second senior Republican on the House Veterans Committee, if my memory is correct.
He's the vice chair of the committee.
Finding any support, any willingness to take your research and maybe add to it with some investigations?
Well, that was actually what we did. We sent our initial, it was an interim investigation report to the congressman and to the House committee with all those supporting information. And we said, look, and this was, I want to say late February, early March. We said, look, this
year?
Is what we discovered thus far, this year.
This year, okay.
This is what we've discovered this so far. And we're not finished yet, but we want you to know this is how consistent it is. Congressman Bill Arrakis and the committee both agreed that there was a significant amount of data to show that there was a problem. We put together a list of recommendations to, for lack of a better term, to play nice with everybody, to put those recommendations in place to not only keep the program intact, but also in anticipation of the program legislatively being opened up to all ears, which is on the book, on the deck right now. We sent that in as well. What the House committee decided to do was, instead of opening an investigation, they're going to start off by everybody sitting down to talk about it. So they held a roundtable discussion in late April. And we were invited, and every VSO was there. Every single VSO out there was represented at that table. So was Congressman Wenchuk, who is the Subcommittee on Health chair, and Congressman Bill Arrakis is there, and several others. The VA national director of the program was there. She was very upset that I kept quoting these numbers. I said, well, they're your own numbers. These are taken from your report. She didn't have anything to say after that. But the first three recommendations that we provided to the House committee and to the congressman and to the secretary, we had sent them to the secretary's office as well. The first one was to suspend all revocation, which they did. Most people in the veteran community know that there was a suspension put in place of all revocation. That was our recommendation.
Wow, that's great.
The second thing was, you trained your entire staff nationwide on the law. The law is only 8 pages long. This isn't hard to read. You sit them down, you make them read it, you give them a little quiz on it to make sure they understand it, and then you send them on their way. They did that. Well, they claim they did that. The third was, and we were very annoyed that they didn't do this, you go through and audit those 26,000 cases that were revoked. Because I can tell you, we have a clinical reviewer that works for us. She actually does that in the civilian world. She actually handles in-home evaluations of homebound patients for Medicare. We had her go through every single case that was submitted to us, and we have over 400 vetted cases that were unlawfully revoked. Over 400. And those were just sample cases that we took from across the country. So we asked that the secretary put together a team and audit those cases, those 26,000. And it's not hard. They have a record of the 26,000 revocations.
So are they doing that? Are they moving forward with some sort of audit, or are they just sitting on
things? Nope. They just said, nope, they aren't even responding to it.
And Congress isn't leaning on them either, apparently? Apparently not.
No, not from what we can tell, because what I've heard internally from our sources in Washington are that the House committee is focusing on essentially rebuilding choice in the second half of their year this year.
Yes.
And that the Senate, because the Senate has on deck legislation to expand the program, that they actually all agree that our recommendations, all two pages of them, are legitimate and doable, but they want to include them in that legislation rather than work through the House and try to fix the program before that happens.
I see.
We've discovered is that basically the rank and file are still telling people, they tell them it's still a temporary program, it's still a rehabilitation-based program. Oh, this crap.
Are you getting any support from these VSOs? And I think it's interesting, Lauren, what you said earlier about how some of these major veteran service organizations, you know, they get funds from the VA. And to me, that explains a lot. We've talked on this show earlier this year about how some of these major VSOs, it's like they're in bed with the VA bureaucracy to impede true reform of the compensation appeals process. And I'm wondering what sort of interference or cooperation or whatever that you're encountering with the caregiver program with these VSOs.
Well, the caregiver program, is a very small program. We've had everything from complete ignoring us from specific ones to middle ground. We had a cool reception, but at least they talked to us from a couple of them. And then the one that kind of surprised us the most, and I will give them kudos, is Wounded Warrior Project. When I reached out to their policy director, John Roberts, he was not just amenable, but he was like, what can we do to help? How can we work together to fix this?
That's great.
So it was. When I reached back to him to try to get some congressional support and more strength on the Hill, I still haven't heard back, but that's okay. We recognize that this is a small program, but what many fail to see is that it's actually not. In dollars for the VA, it is a small program, and numbers, obviously, when they got 22,000 people in it.
Well, that's still a lot of people.
But the legislation that's sitting there, the legislation that's sitting there right now that already has an enormous amount of support that will likely go through is to expand the program to all eras. No, all eligible veterans. There's some specific language that they're saying they're going to keep, which means you have to have some combat-related injuries, things like that, to be eligible for the program.
But right now it's only post-9/11, right?
Right. But if we open it to all eras,
right?
Let's just say the 9 million is the number that they claim are using VA healthcare. Half of 9 million. Let's just say half of those would have eligible injuries to be included in a global caregiver program.
Right.
They can't run a program with 22,000 in it, according
right.
to the law.
Right.
So we're going to dump 4.5 million into it?
Right.
No, it doesn't work for me. But we drive on. We keep pushing.
Right. Well, I applaud your efforts, and I'm really impressed with the work that you've done. You've testified before Congress, and I understand that from our previous conversations that you're a big fan of the Freedom of Information Act, as I am.
Yep.
Can you tell us more about how you and your team have used that law, as well as other techniques, if you're willing to share those with us, to hold the VA's feet to the fire, so to speak?
Well, we've used it several times for a variety of different projects we've worked on. We did a huge claims project, which was written up by several media outlets, and that's what led to my testimony at Congress. Because we called VA out on their claims numbers, and we were able to prove that they were lying. But using FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, has helped us because the VA does not like to give up information.
Right.
And especially if the bonus for us being small, a small organization, is they don't believe we're a threat. So using FOIA has been very advantageous for us because we're not perceived as a threat. Therefore, we don't have a lot of problem getting things through FOIA. Sometimes it does take a while. When we FOIA'd all the numbers from the caregiver program, and initially they claimed that they didn't actually have the numbers. I said, well, that's not true because you present them to Congress. I said, but we want the rest of the ones that you don't give them. It took 8 months to get that FOIA response. And when we finally got it, it took 3 weeks of conversations with the one person tasked with putting it together to make her understand that I don't eat crayons and that she can give it to me in raw data format because she didn't know how to extrapolate the data.
Oh.
She basically sent it to me in extremely raw form, which worked out great because she didn't know how to redact anything. So it's worked to our advantage. I know the stuff I'm doing on the burn pit, when I used Freedom of Information Act to try to get some records about defense contractors' contracts, that FOIA took 4 years, and the information I got when I finally got it was so heavily redacted, I might as well use it to light my fireplace.
Wow. Can you tell us more, since you mentioned the burn pit issue, that's a big topic right now, and I know you've got a lot of personal involvement with Greg Lovett's film. And can you tell us more about that issue of burn pits, Iraq, Afghanistan, maybe what our listeners ought to know about that topic?
Well, I'll make this a short and sweet version. Every single combat outpost and forward operating base in the theater, both Iraq and Afghanistan, and Djibouti, by the way, even though it wasn't a combat operation, use open-air burn pits to dispose of trash. They were ordered by the Department of Defense in late 2008 to hand out paper masks to anyone that had to work around them so they wouldn't have to breathe the emissions from those, which we all thought was really stupid. While they were doing that, they had contacted the agency I was assigned to and told us to start getting prices and quotes on incinerators. And by early 2009, we were ordering and having delivered incinerators to every combat outpost and every forward operating base and theater. They started delivering them early summer. Most of them were going to Afghanistan because we were getting ready to start building up some of the big southern bases there. The ones that were sent to Iraq were never unpacked. The on-the-ground base commanders decided that, and I'm air quotes here, since we're leaving Iraq, we're pulling out, this is, mind you, 2 years before we actually left Iraq,
right.
We're not going to bother with these. At that time, though, to give you an idea, we still had 75,000 troops on Camp Liberty, Camp Victory Base Complex. We still had 75,000 troops there.
Wow.
And it would be another 2 years before that base was shut down. But they decided to send those incinerators onto Afghanistan. Fast forward to 2015. The special investigator for the Army IG was doing an inspection in Afghanistan and discovered that all of those incinerators, if they were hooked up, which 90% of them were not, the ones that were, weren't being used. The SIGAR ripped the DOD over not using them, using terms like, you know, detrimental to human life, things like that. In our country, it has been illegal in every state to open air burn things like household trash, plastic bottles, styrofoam, painted things, batteries, stuff like that, for 40 plus years because of EPA, OSHA, and CDC regulations and tests and research that they've done, knowing that doing that will kill people. To date, the DOD and the VA and I sent you this earlier because it just got dropped in my lap tonight.
Right.
They still, as of February, are still saying there's no conclusive evidence that any of us got sick from these emissions. And now they put out a report saying that the burn pit registry, which my other group, Burn Pit Families Group, got through, is useless, that the data in there is useless because of, and I'm paraphrasing here, the way that they built the questions and what kinds of questions they asked, which is what those of us who did the beta testing on it before it ever went live told them. Asking me if I licked paint as a kid or if my mom smoked when she was pregnant have zero bearing on my lung disease. There are almost no questions on where you were deployed and what type of work you did and what you were exposed to and things like that. They refused to fix those questions before it went live.
So it's clear now, that this registry, if I'm sorry to interrupt, this registry is flawed. Maybe it has some limited uses, if nothing else, as a list where the VA can contact veterans who perhaps might participate in a more serious scientific study, but certainly... It looks like this is going to be the current generation's Agent Orange, like Agent Orange was for Vietnam, where it took them decades of fighting the VA, fighting to get proper studies done. Go ahead.
This is the thing, is what they have now is a list of over 100,000 people, and that does not include those of us who, like myself, I didn't bother to register on it because I knew what the questions were going to be. None of my kids have registered on it because they also know what's on it. And those who died from their diseases that they contracted over there are forbidden from being registered on it. So there's a whole group of people, probably over double what's on there, that aren't even on it. But they have that list of names. The issue is the VA, the Institute of Medicine, just published a report clearly stating that they cannot do the research that would be necessary to prove causation, because the only way they could do that would be using human subjects and exposing them to the crap we were exposed to, which thereby meaning get them sick and kill them. And they're banned from that because of research ethic laws. They freely admit this, yet they all refuse to take, instead of needing more research, we do not need more research, taking the 40, almost 50 years of EPA and OSHA and CDC and the World Health Organization's research into airborne contaminants, especially burn pit emissions. They could take all of that research and acknowledge it because it's what is in the law here in this country, instead of keep saying we need our own research, but then in the next breath say, well, we can't do that research because we'll kill people if we do it.
Well, that's a great point. That's a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's in essence saying we know it's going to kill. We know you're going to die, but we can't do that research because it'll kill somebody.
Right. Well, Lauren, I'm sorry to have to interrupt. We're drawing to our close for our show tonight. We hope that perhaps you'll join us again on the show sometime soon. We continue this discussion. I know the Burn Pits documentary is the premiere in Los Angeles. Was tonight at 7:30 p.m. Pacific time, so that's shortly this evening, and it'll be in Tampa, Florida, thanks to you and many other cities around the state and the country very soon. So hopefully it'll help raise the awareness, and I think your idea is great about using existing EPA studies, and hopefully that will lead to some payoffs to help veterans. Thank you so much for all the work, the great work you're doing for veterans. I wish you the best, and thank you for being on our show. Hope you'll be back again sometime soon on our show. So,
well, I really appreciate the invite. Sorry, I got on my soapbox. Yes, I'd love to come back on, but I really appreciate the opportunity to go over these topics with you guys tonight.
Great. Thanks a lot, Lauren. Wish you the best. Talk with you soon.
Thank you. Good night.
Yep. Okay, well, Richard, I think we're rapidly drawing to our close. I think we'll need to just wrap up quickly, and I want to thank our listeners tonight. Richard, before we close, anything you can share with us?
No, except if you know, our coaching in the care program. If you are a family member of a veteran who has left the service and is having a difficult time transitioning to civilian life, please be aware of the VA's program called Coaching in the Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call at toll-free 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, VA's Coaching into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I would like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has a veteran crisis line. To help, call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they didn't get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Thank you. It's been a quick hour. I'd like to thank our special guest tonight, Lauren Price of Veteran Warriors Group. I'd like to thank our producer here at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Thank our show sponsors, American Legion Post 303, Mr. Charles Newman, and Corey and Hurley Law Group. So hope you'll tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, have a great week. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.